It is a great pleasure to welcome you to the inaugural edition of Council Connect, which is a series we are putting together for our clients and friends, and particularly the in-house council members of our clients and friends, to discuss a series of topics that we think are interesting and hopefully of interest to you as well. And to kick off our series, we thought we would look at the risk landscape for 2024, which is bound to, is already fascinating and is likely to be an increasingly interesting and fascinating year. And who better to kick off the series with than with Zeniat Wicket, who I've known for many years, who is a geopolitical risk expert and coaching advisor, and has had a glittering and decorated career working in a variety of different places, from the White House to Harvard University to Chatham House, and also on the client side at Equinor. Zeniat, great pleasure to welcome you to Council Connect.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me.
I think there's a sense that, you know, every year is complicated and that we're surrounded by complexity and risk and difficult situations. Is 2024 simply continuation of that trend, or is there something different about this year? I'd welcome your thoughts.
Great question to start with. So most risk experts think in terms of numbers of risks, the likelihood of those risks, and the impact. So it's kind of number, likelihood, impact. What makes 2024 different is in each of those measures, there are more risks, they are more likely to take place, and the impact, there are more high-impact risks. So whether you're talking about the US election and how that plays out, US-China relations, the Middle East, Russia-Ukraine, technology, et cetera, this year is fundamentally different. Certainly, you know, I've been working in geopolitics for 25 years. This is the first year where you start the year going, okay, this is a year to watch. What I would say, though, is it would be very easy to think that's all downside risk.
Yeah.
It isn't. There's a fair amount of upside risk. So just to take one, let's take the Middle East for a moment. Right at the moment, it looks pretty dire.
Yeah.
But there is movement, and in that dynamism, actually you could get some positive outcomes along with what are clear negative outcomes that we've already seen to date. So it's not all downside risk. But well, it is risk.
Well, I think it comes, there's always that juxtaposition of risk and opportunity.
Exactly.
And I guess a theme, or rather a question that I'll pose to you perhaps towards the end of our conversation again is the, you know, how do these issues play out, you know, at the organisation level, at the enterprise level? And but I'll park that
okay.
one for now.
I've got an answer for you.
Good. I'm glad you got an answer to that one, because that's kind of, that's how we want to end it.
Excellent. Okay.
So before we sort of get into a number of the issues that you've already mentioned.
Yeah.
I just want to, I guess this is more of a hypothetical, or again, and this is the, taking slightly advantage of the fact that you and I both worked in risk for 20 plus years. Is one of the factors that plays now the sheer volume of data, the sheer quantity of information that we receive on a daily basis, the speed with which now information and arguably misinformation moves around mm-hmm. the world. You know, how much of that is a factor that almost makes us feel like we are mm-hmm. living in a more risky, more volatile world?
So kind of what you're talking about is the distinction between perception and reality.
Correct.
So let me give you kind of two-part answer. The first part is the speed, which I think is a really important point, which is we are moving faster today than we ever have. Perhaps more importantly than that, we are moving slower today than we ever will. Just okay. think about that. I mean, that's a really profound thought. We are moving slower today than we ever will. So, you know, if you're sitting in corporates, you have to accept the fact that this is only going to get harder to manage. This is only going to get faster. So that's kind of point one. That's a really important point. The second point is it just perception that we see more and therefore, and there's clearly an element of that, but It's not only perception, it is also reality. And what you're seeing today, you know, you talked about, you used the word complexity earlier. The complexity has risen. So if you combine misinformation, disinformation, fake news with the fact that approximately half of the globe is going to vote this year,
yep,
those two things combined make for a very complex situation. And we don't yet have the systems in place to effectively moderate the consequences of disinformation with an awful lot of elections. That's still very much in process. And, you know, the big question, is it going to be regulated by government? Is it going to be regulated by the private sector, etc.? Still an open question. But it gets to your point about complexity. So there's no question, just to close that loop down, there's absolutely no question at all that it is reality.
Yeah.
There might be perception laid on top of that.
Brilliant. Thank you. I mean, it's one of these sort of things and questions that comes up, is that sort of, has the sheer quantity of information sort of almost distorted our reality?
But yes.
That's why I wanted to pose the question. You mentioned, obviously, that we've got a pretty significant electoral cycle mm-hmm. kicking in for 2024. Before we sort of get into some of those big electoral races, and I understand you were in India recently,
yeah,
so I'd be fascinated by what's going on there. Clearly,
absolutely,
we've got the US elections, we've got our own elections in the United Kingdom. Before we get into some of those more sort of, I guess, domestic issues and then their broader ramifications, as we started the year, and I know we're already sort of all well into it, what were the big themes? What are the big mm-hmm. themes that you saw that are going to be, I guess, you know, central to the evolution of 2024?
Sure. So I like to think of it, and this, again, thinking particularly, I work with a lot of corporates, thinking particularly of, like, how do I help them think about the world? So I think of it less in terms of lots of issues and more of actually how do we create a framework in which you can think about them? And so the framework that I use is a house, a
yep.
building. And you have the foundations on which, you know, the fundamental architecture of the building that affects whether it's a swimming pool or it's a home or it's an office.
Yep.
You have the systems, the plumbing, the electricity, and then you have the rooms.
Yeah.
And so on the foundational side, the things that I'm watching, and these are things that fundamentally affect the character of how the world is going to play
yep.
out this year. And I'm not going to go into details, but it's things like the energy transition and climate change, technology, both upside, downside, economics, changing societal attitudes.
Yep.
All of these are kind of fundamental, and demographics, five fundamental foundational things that are affecting the underlying character of the building.
And there are a couple of those which I'm definitely going to come back to, particularly that one on societal changes.
Okay.
Because I think as we go through this conversation, there are, and as we apply it, I guess, to the day-to-day realities of living and working and running organisations, that those societal shifts may have are fascinating. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, not at all. And they're fascinating, but they're also the ones that, in my experience, corporates are all over the E of ESG.
Yep.
They're not knowing how to handle the S. And you're seeing this again and again, particularly in the United States, Disney, etc. We've got lots of examples of where corporates just are mishandling the S. So I think it's a great place to dig in. So that's the foundation. And then
yep.
you've got the what I'm calling the systems, the plumbing, the electricity, and that's US elections,
yep.
that's US-China relations, that's what's going on in the Middle East, and that's Russia-Ukraine. Those are the big things that something happening in one of those spaces will affect the globe, but they're not foundational. And then you've got, you know, what I call the rooms that are much more localized, and that's the approximately half of the global population going to vote. So you've got, you know, voting system, you've got civil strife around the world, lots of it in Africa, Latin America,
yep.
you know, and that affects a localized space. You've got what's going on in North Korea that's kind of interesting. And then you have severe weather events. And those, to me, they're relatively small. They're localized. Now, if lots of those happen at the same time, that then has
yeah.
broader consequence. And, you know,
your
one of the big
effect.
Questions for me this year, and then I'll stop, is the global governing system up for the complexity that we're living in this year.
But that raises, for me, sort of one of the key issues is we're absent a global guardian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, perhaps, you know, if we were to go back sort of 10, 15 years, arguably the United States was the one who fulfilled that role, you know, whether invited or otherwise.
Yeah.
But there was a sort of almost a sense that there was, I guess, a direction and a leadership to sort mm-hmm. of, to at least a Western system of global governance. Has that, I guess, the change and shift certainly in the US's foreign policy and its ability mm-hmm. sort of in international affairs, and also that move back across to, or that, I guess, greater focus, for want of a better phrase, on domestic politics and domestic issues, partly for regime survival for some of mm-hmm. the countries that you've mentioned, partly because in the wake of COVID and sort of the more immediate economic consequences of that, you know, are we likely to see the emergence of a global governance system? Are we likely to see a resetting of the sort of the rules-based system? Or should we anticipate, you know, the continuation of more domestic, nationalist and protectionist tendencies that, as you say, on an individual level, probably one can understand and begin to sort of to manage, but if combined, mm-hmm. produces quite a powerful, more regional and then global effect.
So let me.
There's loads in there. So
there's loads. So I'm going to make three points. So I'm going to restrict myself to 3 points.
Okay.
Point number one is, I would say for 25 years the global governance system has been changing,
yep.
and we're moving away from kind of strict Bretton Woods structures to.
Yep.
People find this expression distasteful sometimes, but effectively coalitions of the willing. So people are coming together with interests, will, and capabilities to take action. And you saw that in Afghanistan, you saw that in Iraq, you've seen the G20 was the creation of that. So it's a more uncertain superstructure
yep.
because it's more flexible, but it's also a stronger superstructure for that. So point number one is, yes, the global governing systems are changing, which leads to uncertainty and a sense of insecurity, but it also potentially leads to a stronger system in the long run.
Yeah.
Point two is that we have seen over many decades now a trend towards globalization, and there are some people who say that actually we're seeing deglobalization. No. We are seeing regionalization very, very clearly. You look at trade flows, and this leads to my third point. What you're seeing in trade flows is you're seeing like-minded countries choose to trade with one another, and you're beginning to see fractures between those groups. So you've got kind of the China, Russia, Iran faction, and you've got the Western faction.
Yeah.
And reshoring and friendshoring and corporates moving towards, you know, who historically have always focused on efficiency, i.e. cost, they're now doing efficiency and resilience.
Yeah.
And so you are seeing that, and that has consequences for the world. And it has clearly has consequences for changing trade flows and distribution flows within the corporate sector that companies need to be aware of and need to be acting on. And that leads to my third point, and then I will stop, which is, you are seeing, I know it's complex, but that's what makes it fun.
Exactly.
One of the big system changes to watch this year is the US-China relationship. And how that's playing out this year, so looking at 2024, different if you look ahead, is it's going to be rhetorically volatile. It's an election year in the United States.
Yep.
That's the one thing that both Democrats and Republicans can agree upon, which is China is a threat. So it's going to be rhetorically volatile, but in action it won't be. I don't think we're going to see much kind of real action that makes the US-China relationship worse. How it's going to play out is in proxies. So you've already got a China-Russia-Iran axis forming, and it's playing out in the global south, which is a useless phrase in some respects because, of course, the global south is hugely diverse.
Yep.
But essentially what you're seeing is these two kind of big factions fighting it out for countries like Indonesia and Brazil and South Africa and for leverage in those countries. And that's where it's really going to play out. And again, for global companies, they have to be aware of that. And when they're investing, they have to think very seriously about what's the length of their investments, where do their value chains go, where do they want to put their resources, because this is playing out and it's going to continue to play out over the next 5-10 years.
I think your point about your second point around regionalization, I think, is hugely valid. Mm-hmm. And obviously those have all been tested through events over the past 5 to 10 years, and indeed there's some fascinating academic and other literature appearing around it, and I think for me that sort of sense of shift in supply chains, resilient, the concept of resilience, I think, has become more and more eminent, and obviously I would see that as something of a positive, to your point about perhaps we're seeing shifts but a strengthening in the global governance systems. Equally, I think perhaps an over-reliance in the past upon, you know, a supply chains that just functioned, to now robust
friendshoring, nearshoring.
That sort of, do I have redundancy in those? Do I have alternatives?
Yes.
Comes, I think, to your, you know, the point you made that these present opportunities. This is sort of where, whether it's for a host nation, whether it's for organisations that are already operating within those to you know, offer alternatives.
So I think it's key, and this is where we started, and maybe we'll end this place, but good to get there in the middle as well, which is if all of these have upside and downside. In fact, the only one of these kind of foundational elements to me that is downside is the economics, which is, you know, at best, I think the economics are going to be relatively stable this year.
Yeah.
There's much more downside risk than there is upside risk. But outside of that, the organizations, the companies that can manage this volatility, this uncertainty better, there is huge potential in that. You know, dynamism leads to opportunity. Stagnancy doesn't.
Yeah.
So I think it is worth, yes, it's a little bit intimidating. And we can talk, if you want, about what some companies can do to manage it more effectively. But there is huge opportunity in this space.
We'll definitely get there.
Okay.
So just going back to, I think, some of the themes, just, and again, look, there are, you've mentioned enough in terms of, you know, the US elections, US-China, evolving US-China relationship, proxies, Russia-Ukraine. I mean, we could probably do a session on all of those for way more than the 15 minutes that we've got for this session. But I think what I'd like to, I guess, sort of, we look at this notion of change, sort of look at elections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where better place to start than the US? Just, you know, and again, we could spend a long, long time talking about the sort of where we think this is going to end up. I guess, you know, your view on the US elections, Biden versus a Republican contender.
Okay. So I'll try and make this short.
Yes.
The polls would suggest it's almost certainly going to be Biden versus Trump. I think that there's probably about 30% chance that it isn't Biden versus Trump. So point number one is there's about a 30% chance that it isn't what people are expecting.
Yep.
And it gets back to this uncertainty volatility. There is so much uncertainty. We have never been in a moment at, you know, end February ballpark where you could see both the Republican and the Democratic candidates be chosen at the conventions this summer. Where does the uncertainty lie? On both sides, there's clear uncertainty around health.
Yep.
And then on the Republican side, there's also huge uncertainty around the legal cases against Trump. And that means that even though it looks like it's a Biden-Trump election, I think we're far from guaranteeing a Biden-Trump election.
Okay.
And we don't have time to go into all of the details as to what else it might look like. But the point I guess I make about the US election is, it very much feeds this idea that 2024 is a year of volatility, uncertainty. There's a long way to go. At the moment, the polls are suggesting that Trump will win. Again, I think there's 2 or 3% in it at the moment, so that's too close to call. So it's an open guess. And the consequences of a Trump versus Biden election are less than many would imagine in terms of policy, particularly international policy.
Well, this is the so what factor, sort of.
Exactly. More than many might imagine in terms of the internal consequences for the United States. So that's where I'd say the emphasis needs to be, which is if you're a company that has operations in the United States, it's the domestic US side that is probably going to be more consequential in reality, not rhetoric, reality, than the international consequences.
Staying with the electoral theme.
Yes.
And I recognise that you were out there recently. I used to be based in India. I would welcome your thoughts about those upcoming elections. I think there's a strong belief about what the outcome of those is going to be. I think on the basis that that moves in the direction we all assume, which will be continuity of leadership. Yeah. What does that mean for India? And I think to picking up these themes of sort of change in 2024, how much does that continuity offer India an ever increasingly important global role as well?
So, great question. So I think India is one of those cases of almost the dog that didn't bark. So what was interesting, I was out in Delhi last week. Lots of ministers, including the Prime Minister at the event, Foreign Minister, etc. India's election wasn't a discussion on the panels. It wasn't a discussion in the margins. It wasn't a discussion privately. This is a fait accompli. Yeah. It will be another Modi term, which means more of the same, 10 years, another 5 years, which, if you look at the trajectory of India, it basically means India's trajectory is going to go in the same direction, which is more control domestically, but also, in some respects, more predictability, more organization, less corruption, both positives and negatives. So India is the dog that didn't bark this year. Immensely important election. It's going to offer more of the same, broadly. Consequentially, I'm more interested in the Taiwanese election that happened earlier this year, which I think will have more consequences for 2024 and beyond. The Indonesian election, which happened a few weeks ago, again, that Indonesia is a very big country, largest Muslim population in the world. What kind of turn does Indonesia make? I think there's a lot of questions around that. Potentially, the new government will follow Widodo's path for the last decade or so, but also potentially more of a strongman that could lead Indonesia in a direction that is less palatable for international observers. South Africa's election, I think, is more consequential. Arguably, the EU election's more consequential. Sadly, I think the UK election's probably not so consequential, because the UK has less of an international presence. It matters very much here in the UK.
Yeah.
Will lead to big differences, but internationally lesser.
Just only on a couple of those, because
sure.
Again, we could
keep going.
We could keep going, but the Taiwanese election, just by quickly, just going back to that. I mean, and that relationship with China. And then that sort of raises then the follow-up question to that. China in 2024, where are we? I mean, as you say, you've got continuity in India, which for me, therefore, you're seeing an even greater counterbalance between those two. Economic powerhouses in certain respects. India for a while, and perhaps even more so now, was something of a China hedge for some organisations as they looked at sort of, international opportunities. So I absolutely think continuity and growth in India serves as it's fascinating to see that, India-China dynamic. But more around the sort of, I guess, the Taiwanese elections and what you see that, what that means, I guess, for China, that relationship there, and obviously that then leads into, the US-China dynamic as well.
So,
sorry, there was about 47 questions.
No, that's fine. So the Taiwanese election was won by a kind of more hawkish leader. takes power in May, which potentially leads to more friction between Taiwan and China, or does lead to more friction over the next few years between Taiwan and China. China has some fundamental structural economic problems.
Yeah.
I think of China, one way to think of China is kind of a U-curve with, you know, risk and stability. It's, as long as it's staying in the middle, kind of safe space, it's actually quite stable, authoritarian. When it starts to wobble one side or the other side, you know, if it gets weak, it suddenly becomes a threat, because what China is likely to do if it gets weak, as most countries would, is they have to find an external enemy that coalesces the community. That's a problem. If China becomes strong, that's a problem for the West. And so what you're kind of watching is, where does China sit in this middle space, which is means that China isn't a threat. It's kind of having to deal with its own issues. It's in those middle spaces, but it's moving down towards, because of its economics, it's moving down towards the kind of the weak end of that U-curve, where it starts to get worrying. And then if I look at risk versus impact, I say a weak China is actually far more consequential in impact terms than a strong China. And so for people who are looking at risk, you actually have to consider both sides, you know, both ends of that U-curve. What does it mean?
Then you're getting into regime survival issues, and that's...
Exactly. We're not there, so I wouldn't want to make people nervous, but at the moment it's heading... It's a negative trend rather than a positive trend in China at the moment. And then you've got the US election on top of that, and you have China, what the US would consider to be China meddling, you know, building a stronger alliance with Russia, meddling a little bit with Iran or working with Iran. At the moment, China doesn't need more threats, doesn't need more challenges. And so thus far, to the extent that the US intelligence services know, they've stayed on the right side of what would be a red line.
Yeah.
Long may that continue. I think it will continue because, again, China wants to deal with its own problems, doesn't want more threats. So the signs are this isn't going to get worse over the next year or two. China's economy will stabilize. Hopefully it stabilizes in such a way that they can actually start dealing with some of these structural problems. And I would say for the last 30-odd years, China's been really good at dealing with some of the kind of structural underlying challenges that it has. So there's every reason to continue to believe it will continue to do that. But for people looking at risk, you need to look at both ends of that spectrum.
We'll move on to, I guess, to the sort of the other parts of the house that you have described.
Yep.
And then also, I guess, the part of the you know we always ask, which is the so what factor. You know, what does this mean for organisations? But before we do, just I guess on one of the more one of these issues, just would be remiss not to sort of quickly look at it. And looking at it quickly probably is remiss in its itself, but the Russia-Ukraine situation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we are now at 2 years. Just your thoughts on where that might go in 2024, and again, the consequences of that.
So I will do, again, remiss to deal with it quickly, but I think it can be, which is to say more of the same, assuming Ukraine gets additional resources from the United States and the EU. I believe the Ukraine will get additional resources, both on the military resources but financial resources as well. This year, it's going to be painful. It's come later than they'd like. But as long as they get those, the other problem that Ukraine has is manpower, and that's a real problem that the West can't solve. But assuming those things happen, then we would be foolish to underestimate the Ukrainians. They are fighting for something they believe. The Russians are not fighting for the same thing. And so I think we're going to muddle through this year. What then becomes interesting is what happens in 2025.
And I think this is then, I think, allows us sort of, and I think we've danced across a lot of those topics.
Yeah,
and as I say, we can, you know, we could spend a long time talking about each one of them. And perhaps that's something for future iterations of Council Connect. I think not one, you know, the if we continue with the analogy of a house, yeah. And if an organisation, I guess, is a structure, the houses aren't the same, or at least the inhabitants of it aren't the same. So before, I guess, we get into sort of how do companies manage all of these different issues, mm-hmm. that are potentially affecting them. That issue of societal change is one that I just want to, because I think it segues in nicely, I think, to that final part of it, which is to sort of look how do organisations manage all of these issues. I think a lot of organisations are struggling with that, the notion of societal change, and it can be interpreted in lots of different ways. I guess on the more immediate level, it's, you know, how are companies reacting to the post-pandemic universe? How are companies reacting to what was a dislocation of their workforce? How are companies reacting to, you know, a set of stakeholders that now have different views, different demands, and mm-hmm. different perspectives? I think, you know, you can talk about it on a lot of different levels. I think, you know, if we look at it from within an organisation, how are you seeing organisations manage return to work in its most, you know, that's the most immediate sort of version of that societal change? You know, those sort of challenges, how do you continue to balance changing, I guess, stakeholder, mm-hmm. particularly internal stakeholder demands, with, you know, the overriding, for most organisations, certainly, you know, for-profit organisations, that requirement for revenue, shareholder returns.
So let me actually make two points. One, kind of responding to your framing, which is, why do I use the framework of a house?
Yeah.
I use the framework as a house because if you're a company or an organization that is trying to manage 2024, you cannot chase every far. You cannot chase every geopolitical dynamic. Yeah. So you've got to choose what matters to you. And so where the framework helps is it allows organizations to say, here are the five things in this category, here are the five things in this category, and here are the, you know, four or five things in this category. And so let me go through the list here. And that's going to affect everybody, but let me see how it affects my company in the geographies in which I work, and then do this, and then do this. So I think it's a really, I use it as a tool to allow people to think holistically, but actually break it down into a manageable problem. And that leads to the kind of second point in this framework, which is there isn't a generic answer. Your footprint really matters.
Yeah.
So if you sit in the United States, some of those foundational elements are going to be more or less important. If you sit in Nairobi, others are going to be more or less important. And you may find that actually some of the local issues are more important to you than the foundational ones. So again, you can't have a generic response. As a company, as an organization, you have to actually drill down based on your company. So let me kind of just say that. In terms of specifically, you know, what I call the S of ESG, the kind of social, societal, attitudinal changes, this is where I think companies are really struggling. From COVID to new ways of working to Me Too movement, et cetera, et cetera. And my advice to companies is, again, it's a little about what I said in terms of the framework, is you have to understand which of these issues are fundamental to your business operations, are important and critical to your, not just your shareholders, but your stakeholders. And that includes your suppliers, your producers, it includes your partners, it includes your staff, it includes your financiers, your banks. And you need to have a position on those issues that are fundamental to the business. Those issues that aren't fundamental to the business, you can safely, relatively safely, just say, that's not one we're calling on. And there's some issues that you can say, your CEO needs to have a personal position, but the corporate doesn't need to have a position. So it's not as black and white as many people think it is.
Yeah.
And it really does need to be explored in its detail.
Well, it comes down, I think, you know, to your first point, is it's the translation of threat mm-hmm. to risk. Mm-hmm. It's the translation of the environment one is operating within, and its relevance to your day-to-day.
Exactly.
Exactly to your point. I mean, you can have something going on over here, but it's critical to understand if that's going to have an impact on what you're doing, you know, over here. And I think that has always been one of the challenges. And I think it comes back to sort of one of the earlier things, is that so much noise, so much data.
You have to make choice.
You have to make choice, and you have to filter through it.
Yes.
And I think discern as to, I guess, what is important from a, you know, from understanding global dynamics or regional dynamics, and then translating that to, well, this is what we do today, this is where we want to be tomorrow, and do all of those issues, as compelling and as noisy as they may be, actually matter to how we're operating and our ability to operate safely and profitably.
So the thing that I always say is, what moves the needle? There's an awful lot of things that are going to nudge you, but actually what moves the needle, because you cannot do everything. What my business is all about is differentiating signal from noise. And a conversation like this has inherently got to be generic because, you know, but if we would sit down and say, okay, it's an energy company or a mining company or a consumer goods company operating in these countries, the framework hopefully will then allow you to go, okay, now we can drill down. Now we can actually analyze in a way that is specific to our organization at this moment.
Yeah. Well, I think that sort of dovetails very nicely, I think, then probably into my, I guess, you know, the final topic, final questions is, you know, it is that so what factor. I mean, as you look forward, you know, I mean, I guess we're already 2 months into 2024, so we're sort of firmly in the year. But as we look forward in the context of, as you say, all of the issues that we've briefly touched upon, you know, what is it that's going to, you know, what do companies need to be thinking about? And I think we probably touched upon that sense of, you know, taking noise and filtering through it and finding what's relevant. But would love your sort of concluding thoughts, I guess, on what's going to be helpful to companies as we go through the rest of this year.
So probably the most important thing I would say is don't try to manage the volatility. Don't try to stop the volatility. There's too much of it. It's not going to work. What you need to do is you need to build an organizational structure that is, or a system, I should say, that is better, is more resilient to ride the volatility.
Yeah.
And to take advantage of that volatility. What does that mean? That means in the kind of broad geopolitical space, it means two things, integration and iteration. So companies need to integrate this context analysis into their business processes so that it's coming into the decision making at the appropriate times.
Yeah.
And they need to iterate it because it's changing so fast, to an earlier point, that what may be the right answer in March in Brazil is not the right answer in September. And so it's integrate, it's iterate. Global companies need to ensure that their principles, their values are really understood within the company, because they're going to actually have to let the nodes of the company operating in different countries respond on their own. Again, speed is of the essence.
Yep.
You cannot send things back up to headquarters and then expect to have a locally appropriate answer down in the time that you need to. And so we're kind of reverting to an old system pre-telephone where we actually empowered country managers in different countries. And we actually need to go back to empowering, which means that they have to understand the principles and values under which decisions are being made. So there are things like that. You don't have to. And then I guess the final point is, I get asked by corporates, do we need to set up a geopolitical advisory business within the company? We're a global company. Do we need that? Have that capacity internally? The answer is no, you don't. Actually, in today's world, there are so many consultants out there who have extraordinary knowledge and, frankly, an awful lot better knowledge than your in-house person is going to have. What you need to do is make sure you have some systems in place where you're bringing in external voices, where you're bringing in diversity of thought, so you don't just have for important discussions, the internal voices saying, here are our business assumptions and we're creating a strategy based on that. You have externals coming in and red teaming it and saying, well, have you thought of?
Yeah. That diversity of thought. Well, and I think as an organisation, HK, you know, that is the foundation of our, you know, of our work, certainly in the advisory space and in the risk mitigation space, is that sense of being, you know, an ally, an informed ally to share questions and problems with and to find a solution with.
A trusted friend.
Trusted friend, indeed. And look, and one that faces the same challenges. We are, you know, we're a group that has operations across the world, and so part of it is that we live it ourselves. And I think there's a you know, shared challenge, shared and empathy, but also that expertise to help address specific questions. Xenia, look, we could carry on for hours, and perhaps, you know, this is the inaugural edition of Council Connect. So one, thank you very much for coming. Two, I think there's probably 74 different topics in there that we could come back for different chapters.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for your time. Always very good to see you, and look forward to continuing the discussion.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.